Blog Talk Radio.
Joining me again tonight on this Monday, February 9th edition of Stand for Truth Radio. I hope you have had a fabulous week. I am your host, Susan Knowles from SusanKnowles.com and Stand for Truth Radio. We have a fabulous guest this week, and we're going to be talking about a subject that some know nothing about. Some know a little about, but feel it really isn't real, so they shouldn't concern themselves with it. And some already fully are engulfed in the particular life that we're going to talk about tonight. As usual, if you have any questions or comment, you can call in to discuss at 347-205-9620. But first, before we get started, let me give you a little bit of an introduction to my guest, and then I'm going to bring him on and let him tell us more about himself. His name is Carl Tykrib. He's a researcher, writer, and communicator, and is focused around a big picture scenario, and that is to document and communicate the rise and impact of globalization and transhumanism in its parts and as a whole. So let me bring him on now, and we welcome Carl to Stand for Truth Radio. How are you, Carl?
I'm doing good. Thank you for letting me be on your show today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for being here. I want to get started by just having you tell us a little bit about your background and who you are.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a writer, I'm an essayist, and I edit a publication called Forcing Change. And it all got started already years and years ago, back in the early 1990s. when I was looking into Freemasonry and trying to understand the Masonic Lodge, as my community was very much involved in Freemasonry, and there was a lot of pressure on myself to join the Lodge. Now, Susan, I never did join, but in the research and in the homework I was doing, it became evident that I was witnessing something that was bigger than just my own community. And that was the idea of universalism, that everything is connected, religious universalism, and the idea that man could perfect himself. And so that's where I got my first taste of what we'll be talking about a little bit tonight. And I did it, Susan, because I needed to understand what was driving some of the movements I saw, even within my own town, and what was at the heart of Freemasonry. Of course, it goes far beyond Freemasonry, but that's where I began. That's where I initially started to do this type of a research work.
Okay, and I just want to mention that your website is forcingchange.org, so that everybody can take a look at that website after the show. And can you tell us a little bit and give us a sort of a working definition, if you will, for transhumanism, what that really means?
Well, transhumanism would be the use of modern technology, the use of cognitive technology, computer technology, robotics, nanotechnology, the use of our technological and scientific developments to perfect mankind, to transcend and go beyond being human, or to create a much better human, with the idea that humanity is flawed, and yes, we have this flaw called death and illness and sickness. And so transhumanism looks to go beyond what is normally considered human. Now, there's some good motives in some of it, but there's some real dangers that come with it too. And so as I've studied transhumanism, I realized very quickly that the same idea of perfectibility, that mankind through our technology or mankind through our own advancement is what would save us. That was the theme that, as for myself, a Christian, I found from the spiritual side disturbing, because the realization here was that really transhumanism was saying almost identical to what so many other movements have said in the past, just with its own twist and its own variation.
Okay. And now I know this past week you spoke at a conference in San Diego, and I had intended to attend that conference, and due to my breaking my ankle, I wasn't able to go. But I'm sure it was a great conference, and I know, like I said, that you attended it and you spoke at that conference. Can you tell us a little bit about what you learned and spoke about there?
Absolutely. The conference was the Truth Exchange Think Tank Conference, and put on by Dr. Peter Jones. The core of the conference was to look at the idea that there are really only two worldviews. Everything boils down to either a worldview that says the creation, nature, is God, that nature, humanity, and God are all one, we're all connected as a single cosmic entity, or the Christian view of God being distinct and unique and outside of his creation, outside of the heavens and the earth. And that only those two worldviews, if you boil everything down to its essence, it comes down to either one or the other. Either we're all one, where the creation is what we worship, or we worship the Creator who stands outside of the universe, beyond, far beyond human by any stretch of the imagination. And so much of the discussion was around how those two ideas are in conflict, and then how the idea of oneness or oneism is the dominant worldview, regardless of where you turn, where you look in Western society. Oneism or oneness is what is leading the charge. It is what is moving forward. And then how those two worldviews clash and how we can answer that worldview.
And the people that you saw there, kind of who was there? You know, what group of people or individuals were there predominantly at that meeting?
There were other authors. The head of Ezra Institute, Joseph Boot, was there. Kel Bresner was there from the Cornwall Alliance. A lot of other researchers, there were academics, there was professors who were there, church leaders, and just interested lay people who wanted to go beyond just the surface, beyond just the headlines, to try to understand, okay, what is at the heartbeat of all of this? And it mm-hmm. wasn't a big, you know, it wasn't a big conference, Susan, but there was a lot of weighty material and a lot of things that made you think. My presentation was not on transhumanism, but on a cultural movement known as transformational festivals or evolutionary culture, which is, you could call it, the celebration of oneness. And it is done in a festival setting. And what was interesting is, even as I was flying down to San Diego, at the Minneapolis airport, I ended up sitting beside a young lady who just, with how she was carrying herself and the items she had on her, I could tell, okay, she was involved in transformational festivals. There was cues there. And so I just asked her outright. I said, are you involved? And she looked like she was what's known as a flow artist. I said, are you a flow artist? And she said, yes, I am. Oh, what festivals have you gone to? She says, well, I've gone to this transformational festival and this one. She listed a whole bunch. And then I just simply asked her this. I said, what's common? What's common with all of these different events that you've been to and the transformational movement as a whole? What is it? What's the heartbeat? And without hesitation, Susan, she just said this. It's spiritual. It's spiritual. And again, it just emphasized that this is a celebration, a spiritual celebration of oneness and interconnection. And she ended up leaving, and off she went, and I went to my conference. But for myself, going into all of this, I've been doing this kind of research for a long time, including the political side of oneness. And so if there's a political side, if there's this technological side of transhumanism that looks to change humanity in its own image, if there are all these sides to it, there also has to be a cultural side, and that's what transformational festivals represent, that celebratory cultural side of oneness.
And let's talk a little bit about those transformational festivals. Let's get into some detail. Now, I know there's one festival called Burning Man Festival. Can you tell me a little bit about what that is?
Oh, sure. Burning Man is interesting because it didn't start off as a transformational festival. It started before the idea of a transformational festival ever entered mainstream. It was just simply an event to come, get drunk, get stoned, run around naked through the deserts of Nevada, burn an effigy at the end of the week, and it was just more or less a party atmosphere. But in the last 10 years, 15 years at the outset, it has really changed a lot, and has changed enough that the transformational festival movement looks to it as a groundbreaking, trend-setting festival in the area of changing your spiritual outlook, your worldview, allowing you to feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself, and that collectively you are transcending, that you are birthing a new reality. And so that's what the transformational festival movement, that's how they view Burning Man. A lot of people who go just simply go for the party, for the experience of letting everything loose and interacting with a very, very diverse group of people. But the organizers themselves and the history of it represents something more. They realize that this is about a transforming ritual that will change culture. And it does.
And what I've seen of it is they actually build a structure, whether it's a man or a horse structure or some other type of structure, and they actually do set it on fire during sort of this ceremonial festival. Is that correct?
Right. At the end of the week, they do burn a human effigy. It's a large, large effigy. This last year, I believe, it was by the time the arms were extended, 110 feet high. It was a big structure. And then the following day, that they burn that on a Saturday, the following day on a Sunday, they burn their temple. They also have a temple structure, and it's also a large, large structure. And so last year, you had 70,000 people who were participating in this event. Now, that doesn't mean everybody going is thinking along the lines of what we're just describing, but again, that same theme, that element is there. So it's a big deal. It's a really big deal. Google, and here's what's interesting. While the corporate world is not a part of it, Silicon Valley goes to Burning Man. It's the place to go for inspiration and for feedback.
It seemed to me that there was, on some of these festivals too, there was almost like you had your own little community set up. You didn't, a lot of it talked about bartering rather than using cash. They don't like to use cash during these festivals, and they make things to barter. And is that a correct assessment?
Right. A lot of them are that way. It's a gifting economy. So it has its own unique structure, its own unique design, and that's fine in and of itself. But again, the common theme is that this is an experience in modeling a new reality, in modeling a new future. And while some people might be listening to this conversation going, Freemasonry, transhumanism, transformational festivals, what's all the connection, what's all the linkage? It's simply this. In every one of these situations, man is looking to transcend himself and experience something higher than himself. Man is looking to find some technique or some pathway that will give us a new birth, a new utopian vision, a new model of how to do community. The list goes on of ways to describe it, but it really boils down to man is going to find a way of engineering his own design, his own future. We're going to create a new reality.
So it's the burning of the Burning Man, and when you burn it at the end, is that sort of, burning, getting rid of the man and, moving on to a godlike state? Is that sort of what it represents?
Well, there's been lots of different ways that people have looked at Burning Man. Typically, the man has represented that this is an authority figure of government and the corporate structures that we live under. What's ironic is that Larry Harvey, the founder of Burning Man, I believe it was last year, maybe the year before, in one of his interviews, simply said this. He says, I guess now we're the man, because with 70,000 people, you need to have governance, you need to put structures in place, you need to put rules in place. It's no longer just a free-for-all, free of any constraints. And so he realized the irony of it, that now they have become the man. It's a twist.
Yeah, well, every system needs a structure, or it falls apart.
Right.
So everybody sets out for the utopia, but it never works, So
right.
Tell us a little bit. There's another festival called Lightning in a Bottle. What is that all about?
Well, that one's in your state. It's not that far away from you. It takes place in Southern California. It's been going on for a number of years, I believe, since the year 2000. About 15,000 people attend. And Lightning in a Bottle is noted for its expansion of consciousness, its temple of consciousness. It has its own temple structure. It's noted for the vibrancy of its colors, for the excitement, for that sense of connection that takes place. And again, the idea behind this is that we are going to model a new reality. And more than that, it becomes what they call a sacred container. A sacred container where you, as a human being, can be connected to other human beings. You're connected to nature. You recognize the oneness of your reality, the oneness of God. That again is the same worldview over and over again, just in different ways and different nuances. But it's a big event. 15,000 people. What's interesting is last year I talked to a lady whose son goes to Lightning in a Bottle. And he lives for these events. He lives for the feeling of oneness. And he was telling his mother that it's a place of goodness and wholeness, and he has no worries when he was there. And she was describing all this to me. And then she said something interesting. She said, when he was at Lightning in the Bottle last time, he had his backpack with him, with his laptop, $800 in cash, basically all of his life in his backpack. And he left it on the side of by the side of a tree. He went dancing, and he came back, and it was gone. It was cool, and it just it devastated him, because he realized that this utopia work. In fact, it doesn't work at all. It's a feeling,
right,
but it's not a reality.
Right. Because what it boils down to is we are still human.
Right.
And humans
Bingo.
Do things like that. I also wanted to ask you, one of the things that I noticed too, and looking at another festival, I think from a yoga master, kind of how Christianity is sort of manipulated during that. Can you talk a little bit about that, how the scripture has sort of changed?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've Hindu friends who say, hey, there is no Hinduism without yoga, and there's no yoga without Hinduism. And there's a wide array now of yoga festivals that are very much transformational in their outlook and what they're looking to achieve. And there's no bones about it that this is a spiritual pursuit. Even those who say, hey, I'm just doing it for the physical fitness, there has been some interesting developments to show that while you might be doing it for the physical side, within a year to a little more than a year of continuing on that road, you inevitably end up embracing a spiritual outlook as well. It goes beyond, always goes beyond the physical, and has some course in changing your spiritual worldview in one way or the other. And so there's so many of these yoga festivals that have popped up in conjunction with this transformational movement, because they realize, even at these events, these transformational events, there's large yoga spaces. It's dedicated to that yoking, which is what yoga is all about, that yoking mm-hmm. between yourself and Brahma. You're now yoking with the cosmic God, the cosmic force, however the West wants to couch it.
It seems like, though, they kind of change the wording of the Bible to, like, when Jesus says something, it'll be, you are this. I can't think of the
right.
of the wording that I saw. Does anything like that ring a bell to you, that what they might use instead?
Not offhand, but yes. It's interesting how there's a Christian twist that's often placed within it. And indeed, you know, Susan, the whole New Age always ends up putting a Christian twist. I was just reading this afternoon a book by a prominent New Ager from the 1980s. And as I was reading his book, I realized that the you could read this, and you're picking up Bible verses all over the place, Christian
right.
concepts and themes all over the place, and it sounds almost Christian until you realize that what he's doing is trying to lay the case that you can become your own God, and that you are
right.
divine, and that you are looking to become Christ himself.
And what are the Bible... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, which lends itself to the idea here that, yeah, we can save ourselves. We'll create our own personal utopia, our own social utopia.
Right. And one of the Bible verses that I did, I now remember, it was John 14:6, where it said, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life.
The life.
And I think the yoga master said to the crowd, from what I read, you are the way, you are the truth, and you are the life. Instead of, you know, just
right.
took out Jesus, put in you. So,
right.
and that is New Age.
Right. In fact, if that's correct, that took place, that particular statement, at a transhumanist event I was at in the in New York City, the Global Future 2045 event.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting how, you know, you'll use Christian terminology, Christian language, and yet have a completely different meaning, absolutely a different meaning.
And now let's talk a little bit. I was kind of, you know, maybe I shouldn't have been, a little shocked about Mormonism and transhumanism and how that kind of has gone together in some aspects. Can you talk a little bit about the conference that you attended on that and what that was all about? And I think you spoke at that conference as well.
Right. In 2010, I went to the Mormon Transhumanist Association, their annual meeting. It was just a small event, but I wanted to go because I wanted to know more about transhumanism in general, and why, also specifically, why there would be a Mormon interest in transhumanism. And so it was an eye-opening event. I ended up writing an essay on it. The essay caught the attention of the Mormon Transhumanist Association, the MTA, and I ended up getting some feedback, and we went back and forth for a while. And In 2012, the president of the MTA contacted myself and said, Carl, would you be willing to come to Salt Lake City and give a 15-minute presentation, a Christian criticism of religious transhumanism? Now, you know, when I heard that, when I received that invitation, I was taken by surprise, because I know that in the Mormon community, having an outsider come in giving criticism is not something that is really favorable, not to the Mormon church in a general sense. So I thought, you know, these guys are taking a risk having me come in. At the same time, I knew that I would be the lone wolf in that crowd with a very different voice. They did bring in another critic, but he was an atheistic critic of transhumanism. So I came in, however, as the only Christian critic. And I came in 2013 and gave a presentation. In fact, if you go to forcingchange.org, you can scroll down. And I would encourage you, watch the 15-minute presentation I give to the MTA. You know, Susan, they treated me graciously. They treated me with an incredible hospitality. And when I went there, that morning, I went up to Lincoln Cannon, who was the president of the MTA and is still the president. And Lincoln shakes my hand, and I'll never forget it. He looked at me and he says, "You're brave to be here." And I looked at him and said, "Well, you're brave to have me too, because I know that this is something that could clash." And while my worldview and their worldview is at complete odds, and I am still a critic, no question, still a critic of transhumanism and religious transhumanism, I still consider Lincoln Cannon as a friend, and others in the MTA, I've had some great interactions with them, even though we disagree completely on very fundamental and very important issues. And I guess what that speaks to, and this is the irony of it, Susan, what that speaks to is we recognize that we're still humans, and we can talk civilly and be civil to each other, even while we completely disagree. For me, it was a good lesson.
Now, can we talk a little bit about sort of what Mormons believe and how that sort of, you know, connects or jives in some people's minds that are Mormons to the Mormon transhumanist?
Sure, sure. And this comes out very clear with the MTA, and that is that in Mormonism, the basic idea is that you are going to try to become God or a God yourself. God is only an exalted human being. God was once a man as you are now. And in the Mormon conception of that, how to achieve that God state, all of a sudden people in the Mormon community were looking at technology and the transhumanist movement and said, hey, that gives us the scientific grounds for our theology, that here now we have this ability through technology to potentially achieve this dream of becoming ascended, that we could become more than just simply man. We could work to attain a God status. And so that's why there would be this interest within the Mormon community. Now, not every Mormon would hold to this idea that science and technology will get you there. But this particular group looks at that and takes that in a very serious way.
Because there are Mormons who don't know about transhumanism, just like there are Christians who don't know about
transhumanism. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's why you can't lump it all together. In fact, you know, this fall I ended up talking to two Mormon missionaries not far from where I live, and we ended up on the subject of transhumanism. And I discussed a little bit about what the MTA does, the Mormon Transhumanist Association, my criticisms of it, the interaction we've had with each other. And the one fellow stopped me and said, hey, you know, I don't know if I could follow this idea of transhumanism. I don't think that is something I would consider as being important. And I'm like, well, you know, that's interesting. It's interesting you would say that. And so we ended up having a big discussion. So not every Mormon obviously would hold to transhumanism. However, the MTA recognizes that is a valid fit between transhumanism and Mormonism to achieve the theological end of becoming your own God.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I know in one of the conferences that you were at, you met billionaire Dr. James Martin. And I want to talk a little bit about him. I know he was a philanthropist. I want to talk about what he saw as sort of the problem and what he saw was the answer and why he was interested in transhumanism. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, sure, sure. You know, Dr. Martin was an interesting, a very interesting individual. pardon me. And he provided the most funds, I believe it was to Oxford, in its 900-year history. He was an incredible philanthropist. There's no doubt about that. And he was a firm believer in transhumanism. And Dr. Martin, during the Global Future 2045 Congress that I went to in New York City back in 2013, I had the chance to sit down, talk with him. I probably interviewed and talked with him for about half an hour, and then the two of us went off on our own, and we were walking back to our to the conference area from our interview, and we had a great discussion, a really good discussion, on all kinds of different matters. But what he viewed as being the reason why we need to embrace transhumanism was that he viewed this as one way of fixing our social and political challenges. And so he was all about stemming the tide of human-induced catastrophes, things like climate change and overpopulation and all this kind of an idea. One of the things he talked about at the Global 2045 event was that we needed to bring down the worldwide population of domestic cattle from an estimated 1.5 billion cows down to, what he said, 200,000 livestock, which is just bizarre. I mean, it's impossible. But he did this, Susan, because he believed cows, and this is what the literature says, that cows are the second largest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. And so he had all kinds of ideas. Here was one that just blew me away. He had this plan to create solar-powered climate change cities in the far northern and far southern regions. Now, I live in Canada, Susan. I live in the southern part of Canada, and I can tell you right now, when winter time comes, the sun doesn't get up until 9, and it goes down at about 4:30. There's not a lot of solar power there for 6 months of the year. So it was kind of funny and all, but yeah.
Maybe he didn't travel much because of the pollution and the climate change.
He was well-traveled, but I don't think he had thought through all of the implications of it. He was suggesting what we needed was a global energy grid, and so that we could have this exchange of sun power, solar power across the hemispheres and around the hemispheres, north and south, throughout the course of the year. You know, and here's the thing. I found him very engaging. I found him very personal. As we were walking back from our interview, he said, "Hey, do you have time to go for lunch?" And I regretted I couldn't. I had another interview. I couldn't just take off a half hour or 45 minutes extra and go for lunch with him, though I would have loved to have. I found out that he came originally from a farming background, as did I. We had lots of things to discuss, and so I had to regretfully decline. And then 8 days later, I found out that he had passed away, that he had been found he's been found dead, floating in the ocean just outside of his Bermuda. He had a big mansion, big estate on one of the islands in Bermuda, and a sea kayaker had found him. And I'll be honest, when I heard that, there was a lump in my throat. I'm like, oh, Dr. Martin.
Missed opportunity. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and not just that, but your salvation in technology didn't happen.
Yeah. Yep.
It didn't happen, and that's sobering.
And also, you know, like you said, he lived in a mansion in Bermuda. It'd be interesting to know how he fueled everything. It's kind of like Al Gore with his mansion, you know. Don't do what I say. And I noticed one thing I read, too, that Dr. Martin believed in shutting down all the coal plants. And,
right,
you know,
right.
Interesting. Well, and interestingly enough, I think, you know, President Obama tried to recently do that in West Virginia and kind of, you know, shut down the coal plants. And I think that we may have averted that, but you never know if he's going to come back around and what he's going to do with that again. But, you know, I think when these people think these things up, they don't really think them through and they may live in a world that's totally different from ours based upon the fact that they, you know, have so much money and they don't live in the real world with everybody else.
Well, so. And that's true. That's true. You know, I'll give you another example of that. In 2012, I was I embedded myself at a World Federalist meeting. The World Federalist Movement is the largest pro-world government lobby group. They work very much with the United Nations, very much with the State Department, very much with the World Bank, with the idea that what we can do is we can advocate and push for world government in a world federalist style. And at this event that I'd gone to, there was a world federalist, I believe he was from southern Spain, and he was talking about how what we need to do is to curb our use of fossil fuels, to curb our use of petroleum. We would need to impose very, very heavy fines and restrictions and fees on the use of petroleum. And, uh-huh. and how we needed to do this in order to save the world. After the working group that I was in with this event was done and I'd heard all this, I pulled him aside and I said, and incidentally, this event was taking place in my own home province of Manitoba, Canada. And I said to him, I said, listen, you're in Canada. We are the second largest country on the planet with a population of only 35 million people. We are energy intensive. For 6 months of the year, we have a winter like nothing you can imagine in southern Spain. And if we don't use energy, we don't live here. And what you mm-hmm. have just suggested would mean that my country would literally have to shut its doors and I and my whole family would have to move to a beautiful temperate climate like southern Spain. And he just stopped. He just stopped and looked at me and he went, you know, I never thought of that. Well, your ideas, if they ever become real policy, will really negatively impact people who don't live in the same part of the world you live in.
Right, and it's the same thing we say here about our, you know, Congress and the president. You know, they don't live the same life that we do, so they're out of touch with what's going on, and you just basically, it's a worldwide problem. It's not just here. I don't know if that's comforting or not. One of the things, too, I wanted to talk about a little bit about, you know, all of this that we see in the news and all that, the new world order, you know, that type of thing. And I don't know, I've saw something today that was, you know, very disturbing for me. And I've said all along that I think that, you know, our young people are very primed and poised to take on anything that, you know, like, for example, in the United States, that our government would suggest that they do, whether that is, you know, insert a chip or, you know, virtual reality, whatever it may be, they're ready, willing, and able to go for it. And I know as Christians always worry about, you know, taking the sign of the beast, and some people have claimed that that may be by having a chip inserted into your body. And today, right before we went on, I heard of employees that are having microchips put into their hands that will allow them to open doors, security doors at their companies, or to pay for things at their companies without having to have cash or anything. But they actually have a chip inserted in their hands now. Have you heard of any of these things?
Yeah, yes, I have. A little bit I have. What I find interesting is, as well, we don't know what the mark of the beast will necessarily be, how it exactly gets played out. Mm-hmm. Just the very fact that we are at a point in our culture where we have such an incredible technological ability to track and monitor everything that we do, it gives me shivers to think about how little privacy we have and how susceptible we are to social and behavioral control. We really live in a generation. We really live not just in a generation, but a time, because it's not just the youth, though the youth are susceptible to this, but my goodness, even people my age, and I'm in my mid-40s, closer to 50 than I am to 40, how even we are so susceptible to whatever the latest gadgets are, and how that will wire us up and connect us to the rest of the world. And what really disturbs me, Susan, is that we are forcing ourselves, we are voluntarily integrating ourselves in a society where all of a sudden we will find that it's impossible, literally impossible, to disconnect for the sake of privacy, for the sake of even your sanity, where you're connected in constantly, full time. And I know some people relish that idea. Yes, I'm going to be wired in all the time. I'm sorry. No, thank you.
Well, and I think, again, that's because we have trained a generation. Very slowly, we have, you know, this has been done by progressives or whoever you want to, you know, pin this on, to have us accept the fact that we don't need privacy, that if you're not doing anything wrong, you don't need to worry about it, and that this is all being done for your own good. It's always something that's being done for your own good. And, you know, it really is alarming. And while people your age, my age, and, you know, people over 30, let's say, maybe a little bit older, you know, we kind of still remember that there is such a thing, you know, in the United States, you know, Fourth Amendment rights, and that we do have a right to privacy. But every single day, and especially after 9/11, you know, we basically have lost that, and we continue to lose that, all at the government saying this is to make you safer, while all at the same time, you know, with the NSA and people like that, they have gotten all of our information. I mean, everything is being recorded at all times.
Right. You know, it's not that I'm against technology. Neither are you. I mean, we're using technology right now to have this conversation. But the understanding we realize is that technology is a two-edged sword, and it can be used against you as much as it can be used by you for something that is beneficial. I'll give you two indications of just how, for me, it kind of hit home. One was in 2010 at the Mormon Transhumanist Association meeting. I love books. I love libraries. And the event was held at the University of Utah. During one of the breaks, we just heard a bunch of talk about how we're going to be wired in and we're connected and all of that. And I walked away going, well, you know, maybe down the road. Maybe this is a little more distant than I'm thinking, you know? And then I walked to the library because I wanted to check out some books and see what was all there. And I found the library was basically dead. There was nobody in the stacks. And so I walked into the commons room. Now, when I would go to a university commons room sometime back in the 80s or 90s, visiting somebody or, you know, just going to attend for something, the commons room was always full of energy and laughter. There would be a quiet buzz going on all the time as people are engaging each other, pages are being turned, the whole bit. Well, I walked into the University of Utah, the commons area, and it was silent. And there must have been, 150, 200 students, but it was just silent. And I'm staring at everybody, and I'm like, what's going on? It feels weird. What's happened? And all of a sudden it hit me. They're all basking in the glow of their laptop. They all have their earbuds in, and they're all texting and doing all three at the same time, and nobody knows their neighbors or who's around them or what's going on around them, as everybody already is connected in and living within the oblivion of their virtual existence. And I went, oh, man, we already are in the connected world.
Already there.
Right.
And you know, like you said, technology and improvements in science and all that, you know, I don't think anybody is against that. But some of the things that seem to be sort of taking us further and closer to that transhumanistic, you know, we can become God type thing, you know, is the thing that happened in Europe, I believe, where they're taking the DNA from three people to become parents for a child.
Right. Yes, yes. There's all kinds of examples now where we are looking to stretch the boundaries in a big way. I even with that in mind, I want your audience to understand, and this is simple, but it's important. The only time we play God is when we play God against each other. We cannot build worlds literally from nothing. as God would say, the true God would say, go get your own dirt. All we can do is control and manipulate and shape each other. And that's, for me, one of the more frightening sides of where technology and transhumanism can go, is that this becomes the vehicle to force, coerce certain behaviors, social and political values, political change. There are some serious questions and some serious issues. This is a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another area in terms of that idea of connection. I was at another transhumanist event. This is already a year or so ago, and one of the speakers I was talking to had suggested that, hey, what we need is to have everybody have a chip planted in their mind and literally have it a wireless connection between the brain, allowing it to read your brain thoughts, your brain patterns, your moods, and having that connected into a worldwide web. And so that wherever you go, you are always connected into the system. You are never separate from it. And everything that you want to do, your desires, your consumer habits, everything will be wrapped up in the World Wide Web. And you will be always literally wired in. Of course, it's wireless, but you'll be wired in. You would be connected. You would be in the system. And how wonderful that would be for convenience and security, and on and on and on. And I just, this is the kind of stuff that makes you shudder, going, no, thank you. That's not the world I want to live in.
Well, and I saw something as well. This is something Microsoft is coming out with, and it's sort of a virtual reality type thing that, you wear over your eyes. And I believe they called it holograms, H-O-L-L-O-W, holograms, if I'm not mistaken. And basically, it was for you to sort of exist in this virtual world where you could create and do whatever you wanted to, so that you would feel like a god,
right.
and you would exist that way.
And that's interesting. You bring up virtual worlds. I've been a user of virtual worlds since 2009. I've been in Second Life. I've also have accounts and avatars in two other virtual worlds. And I've used it extensively for doing social research and connecting and interacting with transhumanists and with others. And it's been very interesting. But what strikes me as we are about to enter a renaissance in virtual reality, a renaissance where the lines between reality as we physically understand it and virtual reality are going to be so blurred, and things, headsets like Oculus Rift and other headsets like what you've just described, will help to blur those lines even more. And I really, I'm concerned about the millennial generation, where we find ourselves so connected in already. The millennial generation especially is so wired in. It's the Twitter generation. How easy it will be to lose ourselves, to lose that generation within that virtual reality. And heaven help them, if all of a sudden that technology crashes or we all of a sudden have to find ourselves living in a world where you don't have access to that. I mean, it gets downright weird, even now, when all of a sudden you say, hey, no cell phones. turn off the computer.
Right.
Put the game system away. And all of a sudden, how even that creates conflict already.
Yeah, I mean, in our news here in the United States, there was a teacher who took away the cell phone of a student and basically was attacked by that student because, I know, and we laugh, and it is funny, but if you walk around the streets of America, in every hand, practically, you will see of younger than a teenager, you will see a cell phone, and they will keep it with them constantly, and it's not, they don't even use that hand except to hold that cell phone, and in schools, teachers can't get those kids to turn the phones off. It's almost like telling them, stop breathing. It's a panic time for them, and I could see them, attacking a teacher because you're taking their air away from them. Some of these people, because they have it so much, it becomes a part of their body. It's amazing.
Right, absolutely. When I was at the conference in your part of California last week, when I landed, I had to use a payphone. I didn't bring my cell phone with because, as a Canadian, our cell phone, the way the billing is, the roaming charges would have just killed us. And so I said, you know, when I land, I'll just use a payphone. And I found a payphone, and we try to make it all work that way. And it just felt so awkward not to have that instant connection. And then for one part of the week last week, I rented a car. I rented a car because I wanted to go and see a little bit of Southern California before my plane flew back to Manitoba. And I asked the car rental agency, "Do you have a map that I could use, a physical map?" And they went, "No, but you can get a map at, you know," and then he told me a store. I went to that store. "No, we don't have maps anymore." I went to the Chamber of Commerce. "No, we don't have maps anymore." And I'm like, why don't people have maps? Well, just use your cell phone.
Exactly.
And I'm like, I'm so screwed. I don't have my cell phone. I can't even use what you know traditionally I could use. Where's a map? So, you know, for me, it was a stark reminder of Carl Tykrib. Sometimes you're living in the Stone Age, but you know, I managed to find my way around just fine without a cell phone or a map.
Well, I did get a little lost.
I have to admit, I did get a little lost.
And I was going to say, I have to admit, I don't even know where a payphone is or how much a payphone costs these days. And everything I do on my phone, and I do have a GPS that's on there, and it's wonderful that I, you know, but it just goes to show you, if all of that goes down, we won't know what to do with ourselves. I mean, we seriously won't.
Right. The other thing it tells me, and I've seen this firsthand now, that as we are so connected into the grid, and we are constantly in touch with our social networks, and we're constantly in touch with this virtual existence, we are often at the same time strangers to those around us. We don't even know who's sitting beside us or who's across the hall from us.
Yeah, but hey, Carl, the good thing is we don't need to. We can just make them up.
Right.
Nobody really has to be there. We'll just pretend, and we'll create them the way that we want to have them created. It is mind-boggling, I tell you. Where do you see all of this going? What's your sort of analysis on that part?
Well, from a Christian perspective, what I see is this. I see this idea of oneness, that we're all connected. We are pushing the idea that man, nature, God is all one. I see that ramping up and becoming steadily more vocal, more powerful. It'll find its way into politics. It finds its way into technology and transhumanism. The list goes on and on. That has to subsume everything, because oneness in its nature requires that there be no dissenting voices. You can have diversity, but no dissenting voices that says, look it. At its foundational level, I cannot agree with this. I will not agree with this, and I cannot subsume myself into this. And so I see Christianity being increasingly hated by the world. It already is. As we say, as the Christian community says, look it, we are not God. We cannot ever become God. Read Isaiah chapter 40, and you realize that God is far bigger, far more powerful, and far more awesome than any human being.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see that there's a clash coming. And I hate to say it, but I don't think Christianity, we're going to have a very good time of it. I think it's going to be rough, but it's going to have to call us to examine what is important in our lives. And the important thing is, first of all, your faith in Christ, and then your family as well, and who you are impacting on a daily basis, be it your neighbors, your coworkers, the people around you. And I think it boils down for us as to what Jesus, when he was asked, what is the greatest commandment? And he said, first of all, to love the Lord your God. And then what was the next one? To love your neighbors as yourself. And I think as we do that, Susan, and we do it with the truth that God is outside of the universe and we need to bend our knee to his standard, and we will not become gods, I think we're going to find ourselves increasingly in a minority.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that you're right on that. And I think, you know, Christians are just going to really have to stay strong, and they're going to have to, you know, this is one of the reasons that you need to know the Bible inside and out.
Right.
Because you know, because people are going to come along and they're going to change the scripture. And if you don't know the Bible, you're going to believe what you hear, perhaps, and then you'll, before you know it, you'll be, you know, off in one of these festivals thinking that you're at a Christian function.
Well, you know, and that's, it's a good, it's a good thing to understand, of course, the times and the age that we're living in, which is why we have forcingchange.org and our publication. But really, the bottom line is exactly what you said. Get into God's Word so that we have our minds and our souls girded with the truth of God's Word, and be able then to use that as the lens that we look upon the rest of the world, so that we can, that we can become salt and light to the community around us, so we can speak truth and do it in a way that is loving, even if it means that you disagree with what the world is saying.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that people can do as Christians, you know, is to go to your website at forcingchange.org and sign up and get your newsletter, because I know that you try to keep people abreast of what's going on, and you try to help them along this way so that they won't be fooled by, you know, what's coming and what they see. And I think they, you know, in order to kind of educate yourself better, you need something like that that you can look to kind of get more information and continue to do your own research as well.
Well, yes, and what I tell people is when you sign up to our webpage, you have access immediately to all the back issues and the current issue of our magazine. We have almost, well, we do have 9 years now of back issues. And,
wow.
And Susan, I tell people, take the material, read it, study it, question it, you know, use it as a launching point for conversations, and don't hesitate to send it off to other people. Use it. Literally use it. It's in your hands. Use it. And so,
well,
that's what I want people to do.
No, absolutely. And I, you know, as you go into other conferences and do different things and perhaps get your book finished, you know, I really want to have you back on, because this isn't over. You know, this is a continuing thing that we're going to be more and more of. And when people need to be prepared for what's coming.
Right. And again, thank you, Susan, for allowing me to be on your program this evening. I hope it makes people think and make them consider what truly is important.
Absolutely. And Carl, we thank you so much for your time. And please do keep in touch with me so that we can, you know, hear about new things coming up and can have you back on the show. And because, we'd like to continue to keep learning and know more and more. And we do appreciate your time. Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you. We will talk down the road.
Okay. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
So, you know, as Carl said, there's, you know, there's a lot here, and as Christians, we need to prepare ourselves for what is coming. And I really can't emphasize enough to go to his website, read all that you can read, find information, and really do your own research, because I think that's really important. You know, some of these festivals that he talked about, they're not common knowledge. These people go to remote areas and have these festivals. And there's a reason why they do that. It's because right now it's not mainstream, but it has all the makings of being mainstream. And when that happens, it's going to be like a lot of things that we're seeing right now in our government. It's going to be right there in your face. People are going to come out and talk about it as if there's absolutely, it's okay, and you should embrace that. So we need to be, you know, prepared for that. And I do think that one of the best ways and things that you can do is, you know, to read the Bible, to really know that inside and out, to meet with other Christians, maybe to even talk about this in your churches, and so that more and more Christians become aware of what's out there and what we are facing. Because as I said in the beginning of the show, there are a lot of people that really don't know about this subject. And then there are people who really have heard about it, but just think it's some type of, oh, it's so way out there, you know, what are you talking about? But it's not way out there. It's being accepted more and more every day. And I've known people in their 20s that are participating in this type of thing right now. So we need to learn all that we can learn about it. Please join me next week. We're going to have another wonderful guest. Thank you so much for being here. Have a fabulous week. And come back next week ready and to hear our next guest. And until next week, may God bless you, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care.